Hi, this is Paul, and I have a very special guest here today, Warren Mills. Warren is the guy responsible for bringing me to Australia and putting on that conference there. And I've been trying to get Warren on the channel for a while now because I think today we'll pretty much talk about Warren, and in a subsequent video we'll talk more about your book. This is Warren's book that I've mentioned a number of times over the past year or so. So Warren, I really appreciate you being willing to share yourself here on the YouTube channel.
It's just a delight, Paul. And it's the culmination of what's now several years of watching Jordan Peterson and then you, and all that has involved in terms of not just thinking, but actually changing the way I see the world and the way I engage and lots of things. And it's just been a completely wonderful experience for a 72-year-old.
Well, Warren, you are far younger than that at heart. I know that. Warren and his wife, Elaine, hosted my son Jared and I in their home for the week that we were in Melbourne. And we just had, such a delightful time visiting with Warren. We had opportunity for just hours of conversation, and those were really special times for me, Warren. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, it was a great highlight of this phase of my life, you know, retirement and all that implies, and becoming a writer too, which has taken me several years, but the opportunity to think things through and write things down is one of the greatest experiences I've ever had. And you're right in the middle of it.
Well, why don't we get into your story first then, and then we'll get into Jordan Peterson and the writing and that whole episode. So, Okay. So where, when were you born, and what was that like?
I could say I don't remember.
But surely you've heard stories.
Yeah, no, I have heard stories. I was born in Melbourne in 1946. So I was officially the first of the baby boomers. My mum and dad were married during the war. Dad was a mechanic. And that theme of being a mechanic reoccurs in my life. And he'd lost a leg in a motorbike accident, and that had prevented him from going to the Second World War. So he was a mechanic with only one leg, not that you would know. And we lived in what was my mother's family home, which was a big market garden in Bentley. And the garage where Dad worked was across the road. And so I would get up on the fence and watch the goings on in the workshop. And some of the mechanics, the young mechanics, had hot rods. And so I was hooked from a very young age. So I have an older sister and a younger brother. And we're a bit unusual in that my family were brethren, and the brethren movement was influenced by John Nelson Darby, an Anglican clergyman, an Irish Anglican clergyman, who popularized the idea of dispensationalism that was later enshrined in the Scofield Bible. And the idea of that is that God deals with humans with very distinctive dispensations throughout history, which of course is true, but he took it to the nth degree. And so we considered that we were the only ones that were, the faithful remnant, and which we knew wasn't true, because we knew that the brethren were weird. And so it was a throwback from Anglicanism And they had rejected all of the institutional hierarchical sort of structure. And we met in gospel halls, which were very plain buildings, bare wooden floorboards, no clergy, and anyone could speak as long as you weren't a woman. So I learned to speak as a 12-year-old, and I was baptized as a 12-year-old, and the sort of you'd come of age if you could contribute to the communion, you know, the worship service, by giving a hymn or giving a word or reading scripture or something like that, which I did. And so I've had a sort of a high degree of reassurance of, you know, my self-importance, I suppose, from a young age, which people have described in various ways that I can't mention. They all include the idea of being a know-all, though. So I went to the local primary school and then technical school in Brighton, and developed friendships that have lasted more or less a lifetime. And I wanted to be a mechanic, and I ended up getting a job working for Repco, which was the company that my dad worked for, in research and development as a technician. So at a very young age, I was designing engineering devices for cars and trucks and tractors, and making prototypes, testing things. So that's really a lifelong theme. I've been a creator of mechanical things, working with my hands, which I still love doing. So I worked in the automotive industry, mainly for Repco, later for a national tire retailer called Bow Repairs. And I was in and out of management and or training positions really from the early 70s. And so I did a training qualification, and then I was variously self-employed in my own business that I bought off Repco, or went back to Repco in a state management position. And we, as a family, lived in South Australia and moved around a bit. Then that was short-lived, that job, and ended unhappily. And so we moved to country Victoria, to a place called Sale, which is a couple of hundred kilometres from Melbourne. And we lived with a community called Fusion, led by another brother guy, Mel Garvin, who was a bit of a guru. And so I ended up studying what they called a Diploma of Youth and Community Work for 12 months. And that was when I was 40. It was very significant that I took that time out from, you know, ordinary employment. And we lived on a farm, and I did that study. And that had a great impact on me that still remains. And so we came back to Melbourne. We'd kept our house, our family home, and the kids completed their secondary education there and eventually moved on. We sold our house and moved to the city fringe, to Albert Park, which is where they have the Formula One Grand Prix. And we bought a tiny house near the school that Elaine became principal of, and which happily doubled in value in a short space of time. It was a very good experience. I also built a car during that time. I built a racing car. And that was a fabulous thing to do. a bit of a diversion in some ways, but in other ways really important to my sense of being and self-worth, I suppose, and important. It was a recovery, really, from a business disaster that I'd had. And so we eventually sold our house in Albert Park and bought our apartment in Docklands, where you stayed, which is right in the city, more or less, and overlooks Port Phillip Bay, Victoria Harbour. And we really love being here because it's so convenient and the view's pretty good.
Now you should mention a little bit about the first book you wrote before the Christian one.
Oh, yeah.
That one's not published yet, but...
No, it's not. No, I've got to revise that slightly. It's got to do with my interest in being a petrol head. So petrol head, petrol is gasoline. Really all my life. And I'd followed the fortunes of an American drag racer called Big Daddy Don Garlitz, who's from Florida. And that was unusual because the sport in which he was participating that became drag racing was all in California. And so here's this southerner coming across to California and taking home the money, which was a great accomplishment, really. So I followed this guy from my early teenage, because he started to become recognized in the 50s, mid-50s. And in the about early 70s, he had this horrendous accident in Los Angeles where the transmission on his dragster exploded and cut the car completely in half on the start line. And it took off part of his right foot. And so he ended up in hospital in Los Angeles in great pain and refused painkilling medication. So the hospital staff more or less abandoned him because he wouldn't take painkillers. So he recalls that he called out to God, and that a sense of the presence of God came into the room, the pain went away and never came back. Now, I was intrigued by his story, not that I knew that part of it, but later he put the cross on his car and the words, God is love. And so I've written a book about him, and I finished that perhaps 4 years ago. And I submitted it to HarperCollins, who said it didn't fit any genre, so I put it aside. So I've now sort of figured out how to revise it, because this guy Garlitz is a strange sort of a Christian. He's really an enigma, I think, and a compulsive, brilliant, competitive sort of a guy, and I've drawn tremendous inspiration from him. And so I went and visited him with a friend of mine, Eugene Newbone, who you've met, and interviewed him, and he had some shocks in store for us which are in the book, and it's all part of this story. But I think he's an extreme example of someone wrestling with the issues of faith and integrating them in an interesting way. And his story really is attributable to his wife, who's now deceased, and her encouragement of him. And she was a Christian, a practicing Christian, and he sort of was in the way that you are in the southern states of Florida. But he's got a very interesting story to tell. And so I'm really telling the spiritual side of his story. And so I'm looking forward to publishing that next year as a follow-up to How Good is the Golden Rule?
Wonderful. Now, you and Elaine fairly early on got over to Europe. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting that you and I have spoken about this, one of the interesting dynamics of the Jordan Peterson phenomenon is that there seemed to be a lot of connections with the Libri movement that was, you know, that took off in, you know, behind Francis Schaeffer. And I thought it was early on in my journey with this, I thought it was amazing how many people I was talking to who had made it to Libri and who were also sort of circling around Bernd Power, who I've done some conversations with on this channel, same with him. So how did that impact your, so you grew up Brethren, dispensational, what happened at Libri for you?
I guess Elaine and I were already married by that stage, and I suppose I had started to investigate. I'd already come to the conclusion that dispensationalism was a completely blind alley. It didn't make any sense at all. And so I had rejected it, but without rejecting Christian faith. And so Elaine and I had very consciously agreed that we would always tell each other the truth. It's a very interesting observation of ourselves. I wouldn't say that we've done it all that well from time to time, but we've been fairly, you know, persistent, I suppose. And so we decided after living interstate, and we'd come back to Melbourne, bought a house, and we decided that we'd go to Europe. And someone gave us a book by Edith Schaeffer, Francis Schaeffer's wife, called Labrie, which is the name of their commune, it really was, in Switzerland. And it was a beautiful story and so elegantly told. Well, that's right, another friend of ours had been there. And so we decided to make that a destination because we were, you know, inquiring and testing our faith and which we shared really all of our time together. And Elaine was 16 when we met and first started dating. So we went to London, bought a car, an MG GT, and traveled the UK. Then we went to Europe and stayed with some friends in Holland, and then more or less made a beeline to Libri. And it was a really warm summer, and there was people everywhere, and the village and Libri was completely crowded, and there was no room for anyone, which didn't matter to us because we had a this small car and we'd bought a roof rack and camping gear, and we had it all in a box on top of the car, and so we could stay anywhere. And so we were invited to camp on a farm up the mountain, which we did, and we pitched our tent, and then found that there was all of these others, Americans in particular, plus some English guys, living in the barn, also attending lectures at Libri, which was several kilometers down the mountain. But they had no car, and so we would transport them. And the MG GT has a rear hatch, and you could lift a hatch and lay down the very small rear seat and get them to all lie in the back like sausages. So you could carry three or four of them in the back, which was very convenient because, as it turned out, their names were Nicky, Nicky, and Nicky. And they turned out to be Nicky Gumbel, who was the popularizer of Alpha, Nicky Lee, who's gone on to work with Nicky Gumbel and develop a ministry to do with couples and marriage with his wife, Scylla. And Nicky Hills, who interestingly was a friend of Justin Welby and was responsible for his conversion. And he's now the Archbishop. Is that the right name of the Anglican Church?
You're the Anglican, not me, so you should know the titles better.
Well, that's right. I'm a fake Anglican.
Wow.
And so that was an amazing experience to meet not just those guys, but others from America, including another guy from, I forget where, but Bill Chilton is a 6'8" architecture student when we met him. And he's now, and has been for many, many years, a partner in one of America's biggest architectural firms, Picard Chilton, I think it's called, who've been responsible for some of the biggest and best buildings in the world. And so that all came from that very condensed time at Le Brie, where we heard Francis Schaeffer speak, and of course we'd read his book or books by then. Probably more significantly, we were introduced to Oz Guinness and his book, The Dust of Death, which I think is one of the absolute great books of this era, in that it almost completely predicts the demise of Western democracy. And so I've gone back and back to that book. It's up there on the shelf somewhere.
I've never read it.
Yeah, fantastic. He's a colleague of Ravi Zacharias and a great, you know, sort of a social critic and an apologist. He's the heir to the Guinness family fortune.
Is he really? That Guinness? Yeah. I didn't know that either.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. And so Schaeffer was one of those sort of gurus who was impenetrable, really. But if you're serious, you'd have a go. You'd at least talk about his books and, you know, his ideas. And he's been tremendously influential, in that I've got his books and I've gone back to reread them and to try and understand them and make sense of them. The other constant I find is C.S. Lewis, and the extent to which he sort of permeates contemporary Christian thinking. And some years ago, I realized that everybody that I was interested in talking to or reading quoted Lewis. And so that's been tremendously significant. And there's some others, but they're the main ones.
So you grew up dispensational, and then what was kind of the next permutation of your faith? I mean, was it affected by Schaeffer and Lewis and Guinness? Was that sort of it?
I can remember the intellectual journey that they prompted, and coming to the conclusion that it was that it could be pretty unsatisfying if it was just intellectual. By that time, Elaine and I got married, and we'd lived in West Australia for a couple of years before we had any kids. And then we'd come back to Melbourne. I was working with Repco, and we opened a new business over there. And we built our family home, and the local church was a Uniting Church, and so we decided to go to that and develop some good friendships that have endured. But I became really dissatisfied with the Uniting Church, which is, I guess it's like the United Methodist Church in the US, and quite liberal and progressive. And so I had decided myself that I would explore the Pentecostal phenomenon, which I knew a bit about. I'd done some reading. And of course, the brethren, who are cessationists, the spiritual gifts have ceased, you know, the miracles have ceased, which was completely the opposite of what the Pentecostals were saying. So it's a long story, but we ended up there in a very small Pentecostal church in a local school. And that was an incredible experience where I wanted to engage emotionally. So I'd done quite a lot of intellectual work, at least to satisfy myself. And so I sort of had a good idea of what the Pentecostal idea was, but I wanted to experience it. And so, of course, one of the big things in Pentecostalism is speaking in tongues. And if you can't speak in tongues, you haven't made it. You know, there's something wrong with, well, there was something wrong with me. And I was lying in bed one morning, and Elaine was in the shower singing, which was a bit unusual. And I realized she was singing in tongues, and she'd never done anything like that before. I was really jealous. Well, this has happened a few times in our life. But, you know, there's something that I've wanted to pursue. She just does it straight away. Anyway, so of course, eventually I got to speak in tongues. And there were certain cultish aspects, though, to this fellowship, which we were aware of. But it was an incredible experience, really fantastic. But we could see, you know, the whole thing writ large about emotional experience and glossolalia and healing, all that sort of stuff. We could see it all. But, of course, it's easy to distort that and make that the primary thing of faith rather than an aspect. So we eventually left. Actually, we went as a family to live in South Australia, where I went and managed a Ripco business, and eventually came back to Melbourne, and I got a job in Bow Repairs, which was a big national tire distribution business. Now belongs to Goodyear. And that was just a really great experience. I'd created the job myself by approaching them and making some observations about the potentials that they were missing. And so they eventually gave me the job. And I became the training manager. And they gave me absolutely open slather to do whatever I wanted. And so I'm quite imaginative and creative, and so I did some really interesting stuff, which became the basis of my business for the next 25 years or so. And so eventually I left Bow Repairs and joined a consulting firm, and eventually acquired that business myself, and I became a consultant to the automotive industry. And we had some incredible successes and developed some really interesting new ideas. But eventually I bit off more than I could chew and created a huge disaster by being far, far too ambitious and just thinking that because I was in this privileged position, that things would just work. And of course they didn't. And it literally cost me $1 million that I can account for, plus a lot that I can't account for. And that was a big setback, which is why actually I built the car. Building the car was the recovery from that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the reoccurring theme has been to make intellectual inquiry, because I'm curious and open to not anything, but a wide range of things. And then say, okay, well, that's interesting. That's good. How does it work? And so I want to experience it firsthand.
So you did the Pentecostal thing, and what happened after that?
Well, when we came back to Melbourne from South Australia, which was our year, well, it ended up being almost 3 years away, would you believe we decided to attend the local Brethren Church, which was quite close to our home. And David Raitt, who you've met, was the youth pastor. And it was a tiny church, but had some really excellent people in it, including David and George Morgan, a lawyer, and Lynn Rauber and some other guys. I guess it was a sense of mission to try and bring the Brethren into the 19th century, in which I failed completely. It was a completely hopeless task. And so I tried to introduce some of my Pentecostal insights, and well, you can imagine how that went. So there's lots of ironies in that whole experience, which introduces a very interesting principle that I learned there, which is to do with the concept of paradox, which I'd been investigating already, because I think that the teachings of Jesus are inherently paradoxical and ironic. And there was a guy at the Brethren Church in Notting Hill, it was called, who was into this subject of paradox. And he introduced me to a French theologian named Jacques Ellul and his book on Ecclesiastes. It's called Reason for Being. And so I've read that book for the last 30 years and reread it. And it's a tremendous insight into the wisdom literature and the idea of irony and paradox, and in fact, contradiction. And so that's introduced an aspect to my thinking and experience where I expect paradox and I expect irony. And I delight in it. And I think that that's at the very heart of the Christian message. So that's a bit strange. It's hard to explain, but it's given me enormous resilience and optimism, I think. So we eventually abandoned the the Brethren and went to a big Baptist church, which was also not far from home. Which is now Australia's biggest Baptist church, called Crossway. And that was a great experience too. We had a really big home group and we saw people become Christians and grow in their faith. And of course we did too. But eventually we left because we'd sold our house and moved to Albert Park. I guess my real adventure, though, occurred when I started to stop working so much. I wasn't retired, but I had the opportunity. Actually, what happened was Elaine became principal at Albert Park Primary School, and that created the opportunity for me to not have to work full time. And so I started blogging and participating on an academic site called The Conversation, where I learned to argue with atheists and skeptics, and so that was a tremendous experience, learning experience about how to argue clearly and not just rely on the God of the gaps and that sort of thing, and then that coincided with me joining a men's group at our Baptist church, which by that that time was at Albert Park, again, not far from home, with a North Carolina native named Stan Hankins. And I eventually realized that I needed to treat that group seriously and start giving proper answers to questions that would come up in the group. And so that's what led to my first book about Don Garlitz. Mm-hmm. And that also led to a thing that I created called Bunch of Blokes, which came out of my men's group, and it was my writings that I'd provided for them and stuff that I had written for the Don Garlitz book but not used. And I was still consulting to the automotive industry. And one of my long-standing clients is a guy named Phil Munday, who's a very successful crash repairer, panel beater. And so I was out seeing him, and I gave him the draft of my book, because he's a petrol head as well, a very successful petrol. And I said, look, I've got this other thing. It's really material for men's groups. And I said, I think it's got some potential, but it needs some support. He said, what support? I said, oh, well, I need $100,000. He said, oh, okay. He gave me $100,000, which he's since done again. And he was actually my guarantor for the conference. So that's another long story. But in turn, I gave that money to David Rate, who is the director of ministries for the Brethren Church, would you believe? So he had all of the administrative stuff, and plus he's a creative guy, a good thinker, and quite disciplined in the way that he goes about things. He, by the way, had been in the US as the president of Youth for Christ for 10 years in Colorado. So enormously experienced. And so he and I collaborated on this project and created this Bunch of Blokes material, which is really resources for men's groups. And we based everything we did on the Golden Rule. And so the book, How Good is the Golden Rule, was intended originally to be just sort of the collected writings of a bunch of blokes, which I quickly found to be unsatisfying. And so by this time, I'd met Michael Murphy, who became my publisher. I didn't know he was a publisher, and he's a Catholic guy. And so we decided that there was so much common interest between us that we ought to do some sort of project together. And I said, look, I've got a book I want to write. And he said, well, I'll publish it. And so that's how the book came about.
Now what caught your interest, or what need caught your attention for men's groups? What had you been seeing?
You know, the first thing was the relationship with Stan Hankins. He was an exec with IBM, and had come out to Australia to run part of their business. And he's a good guy and a very generous, open-hearted, intelligent, as a lot of Americans that I've met are. And the reason is that their companies had sent them to Melbourne to run their businesses. So they're senior executives and they're well-trained. And if they're Christians, they look for a church, and an easy solution is a Baptist church, which we were attending in Albert Park. And so at one stage, there was a cohort of 50 Americans. Wow. At Albert Park Baptist Church. It would have been half the congregation easily. And they would come and go every few years. But Stan stood out. He had a young family, two teenage kids. He was pretty tough with them and had very high expectations. And he announced that he was going to have a men's group in his home. So I thought, gee, I should be part of that. So I joined with him. And he had a very relaxed style, and his wife, Gigi, was very hospitable. And we would just sit around in the kitchen and eat food that Gigi had prepared and talk about sport and politics and stuff. And then we would watch Alpha or something like that and discuss it. And so that made me think that I should be more responsible in terms of making statements and following up with some serious study about various topics. I remember one of them was, I quoted the scripture where I think it's Jesus who says, some of you cross land and oceans to win converts and make them into bigger devils than yourself. And when I said that, there was this incredulous sort of response from the group. They said, how can that be? You know, and it was before the era of everyone's got a mobile phone and you just dial it up. And so I went home and did the research and wrote some material about that, because I think the general idea was that if you're sincere, that everything would always be okay, and that sincerity was probably the highest value. Well, it's not true. And so here's Jesus saying it's not true. And so it was a bit of a mind-expanding experience for us as a group to delve into some of these subjects. And there was one guy in particular who had just experienced a divorce and was going through some really difficult times then. And so we as a group were able to support him and encourage him, and not so much tell him what to do, but listen to him, I suppose. So I started to get a bit of a handle on how the golden rule applied in this sort of a situation. And so it was really my writing about that that became Bunch of Blokes, which, by the way, is www.bunchoblokes, all one word, .org. So go and have a look.
I will definitely have the link in the notes.
Very good.
Now, you and I obviously met because somewhere along the line, you found Jordan Peterson. So how did that happen?
Well, I mentioned that I'd started to become a regular participant in the conversation, which was really an academic, not so much a blog, but an academic site for publication. And my niece was working for them, and she introduced me to it. And so I started becoming an avid reader and participant in the conversation. And so my profile on the conversation says that I'm a grumpy Bible-bashing contrarian. So I made no secret of my...
Well, that would get you lots of friends in a community like that.
At least they knew who they were dealing with. And so they couldn't accuse me of that. Anyway, that taught me a tremendous amount about, you know, the current worldview, especially in academic circles. And I was pretty much a lone voice. Occasionally you'd find a Christian contributor, but it was me by myself most of the time. And so they would ridicule everything I said. And so I learned not to take offense and to persist and find the weakness in their argument. And they often mention Jonathan Haidt and as being one of the best of the contemporary sociologists or, you know, social scientists and philosophers. And so I started to watch him on YouTube, and he mentioned Jordan Peterson, and so I started watching Peterson. And I already had an introduction into what Peterson was saying about Jung and the whole Jungian archetypes, because our neighbour at Wheeler's Hill, Sherry Bajada, was a Jungian therapist. And she'd done a number on me more than once. She was right about that too. And so I had attempted to study Jung years and years earlier, and I'd given up. It was too hard. And I was far more prepared to put my energies into, you know, understanding Christianity in the teachings of Jesus. But I had a good introduction to it. So Peterson was saying things I already knew, but with renewed clarity and emphasis. And I remember him saying that about the importance of the logos, the word made flesh, you know, the word manifest, and how that Jesus is the logos of God. And then he said, each of us have got a logos. Each of us has a word, the thing that we believe to be true. And we need to not only articulate it, but to be consistent with it. And so I knew that too. I knew about integration and what we think, what we say, and what we do. But I was really powerfully convicted to deal with some situations at the Baptist church that we'd been attending for 17 years by then, to do with the new pastor who really I had sponsored and encouraged her into her role. But she'd taken a very progressive, pro-LGBTI position, and I'd criticized her, but only really in private. And so now the issue was coming to a head, and she was using the notice board out the front of the church to, you know, to promote her ideas about acceptance of LGBTI lifestyle. And so I decided that I couldn't tolerate it anymore. So I gave her some pretty clear instructions. And so she organized the leadership of the church to silence me. And I'd been the secretary for the 17 years that I'd been there. And this was a complete abuse of power and an affront. But I realized that my time at Albert Park Baptist had come to an end. And so so we left and joined the Anglican Church, St. James, which is really walking distance from home where we now live in Dockland. So, you know, it's a funny experience. And in one way, you know, we're sort of leaping from one disaster to the next. But
that's a lot about life.
Making progress all the time.
That's right.
So, you know, the thing that I've come to understand, though, is that we can be participants in the kingdom of God now in a very comprehensive and wholehearted way, which is not just exciting, but tremendously fulfilling and satisfying. And so I've really, I suppose, since becoming a grandfather, now six times over, understood the concept of righteousness, peace, and joy. in the Holy Spirit. And so that's really a central theme in my book. So the simple equation is that faith, hope, and love lead us to Christ. And so the inputs of faith, hope, and love, which we contribute, the output is righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Spirit. And so we don't just understand the kingdom of God intellectually, we understand it experientially. And it's the whole of our being, as I mentioned, body, soul, and spirit, thought, word, and deed. And so this integration is so comprehensive and satisfying and fulfilling. But that's only the beginning. We've seen the future, and not just the future of time on earth, but the future of the kingdom of God and the idea of eternity. And that's completely mind-blowing. So that's a concept I'd been introduced to in the early 80s. And it's a bit of a long story, so I'll give you the short version. It was at work with Repco, which at that time was undergoing massive change, and this guy had acquired the business and was introducing all sorts of new ideas. And he ran a series of videos for management at that time called New Age Thinking. And it was New Age, but the presenter was an American sports coach named Lewis Tice. And I was pretty resistant to anything to do with New Age, but eventually this guy won me over. And he said very much later that we live in a Newtonian world of cause and effect. So Isaac Newton was the great discoverer of modern physics. And since the Enlightenment and, rationalization and the rise of the secular and the decline of religious and spiritual, that we live in a world of natural law, cause and effect. And Newton said that if we understood science well enough, we could understand God's mind and predict the future. And Lewis Tice said, well, actually, we now live in a Newtonian world because science is all around us. Technology has taken over and dominates everything we do. He said, but actually, we live in a Whiteheadian world. And he was talking about the philosopher and mathematician Alfred North Whitehead, who spent most of his career in the US, by the way, who had developed a theory that became known as process theology, that says we don't live in a cause and effect predetermined world. We live in a world where we're invited to participate in a creative relationship with God, and that that's the future, and that's the reality. And so I think there's some dangers in letting this idea go too far, because God is still sovereign. God is still absolute, but he's not controlling everything. He's inviting us into a creative relationship. And so that idea completely got a hold of me, and I studied process theology for several years until I realized it was pantheistic. Or it tended to become pantheistic. But that's a vision of the kingdom that I've seen and I find tremendously exciting. And so what we're experiencing now is very partial, very, very much limited by time and space. but there's something much, much bigger, much better coming. And it's creative relationship. We're sons and daughters of the Most High, co-heirs with Christ. That's mind-blowing.
Well, so I loved your little sermon, but you found Jordan Peterson. You got interested enough in Jordan Peterson to do a conference. Now, one of the interesting things that I've noted even after my trip there, Peterson's talks in Australia, he posts them more than any of his other talks, and it often seems that it's his talks in Australia that he gets into some of the more interesting things that you and I have interest in terms of the religious aspect, you know, more necessarily than the political aspect that he talks about. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I guess Australians might be a bit less complicated than some of his other audience. I don't know. He became well known very quickly in Australia after the Cathy Newman interview, and he had some similar interviews in Australia with the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, and he also had hooked up with John Anderson, who was the previous Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, and had done some interviews with him that were well known. I guess just clarity and simplicity of message, and not too much complicated by the politics as it might have been, particularly in US and Canada. We don't have that sort of same political, things being overheated politically here, at least not on that subject, or, you know, the sort of things that Peterson talks about. So I think, though, from my point of view, Peterson became not repetitive, but he wasn't really saying much that was new after the first sort of gloss had worn off, which was why I found you so intriguing, because you're on a journey of discovery, and I think that your discovery of John Peugeot and John Vivaki and the many others that are now part of your global congregation are just absolutely fascinating. I don't even try to keep up, but but I glance at everything that you post to see if there's a connection to what I'm thinking about, and I've found the experience of engaging with Peterson and now you to be endlessly intriguing and confirming and inviting new discovery every time I listen to you.
So what have you been thinking about lately?
Me? Alfred North Whitehead. And I'm returning to him because his idea of us being invited into a creative relationship with God is so completely mind expanding, and I think completely logical. And so I find that to be tremendously intriguing and fulfilling. I don't preach it much because it confuses people. But that's the real answer. However, I've also done some further work for a bunch of blokes on the idea of quality of life and picking up on Robert Persig's idea. And I've done some work on developing a quality of life tool, which is a framework and a questionnaire to ask questions about a person's experience of quality of life. And then it sends them on a journey of what I call an inward journey, which is really self-examination. And part of my theory in my book is that there's, which is really, excuse me, an Alfred North Whitehead idea, that there must be an inward journey of discovery, and it then must be followed by an outward journey of sharing with others. And so I think the Golden Rule suggests that we love God with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength. And that implies the inward journey. But then it says, and our neighbor as ourselves. So we have to use our self-discovery in our relationship with other people. And to not do so is inconsistent. It's a contradiction, mm-hmm. which is another Whiteheadian idea, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll have to bone up on my Whitehead. It's interesting how, you know, I first came across Whitehead's name through C.S. Lewis, because C.S. Lewis would quote him. And he's referenced, I think, a couple of times in Lewis's book, Miracles, which is one of my favorite Lewis books. So, I've been picking your brain, and I do want to save a much more thorough treatment of your book for a subsequent video. Anything you want to touch on before we end the recording?
No, I've really been anticipating this discussion, and just to remind you how much I appreciate you, and I think you probably ought to reserve a bit of time in your calendar next year and get you back, and it'll be the Paul van der Kleef phenomenon next time. But we're going away for a month. We're going up to toward Cairns on the East Coast. And I'm taking a couple of books with me by Walter Wink, who's a liberal theologian that I've had for years, and I'm going to reread them because he's really talking about the spirit world. And he does it in such an elegant and insightful way, and I need to understand that more to understand what's happening in the world today. And so, yeah, I'm on a journey, and you're very much part of it. And I'm just looking forward to the challenges of the immediate future, because they're the precursor to an unbelievable future in eternity.
Yeah. And I so appreciate, and you know, as I said before, I so enjoyed, we had time to talk, and it was such a pleasure. I love the fact that you're a petrol head and into drag racing, built your own car, of course, learned business and consulting and training world, but then at retirement decided you were going to write. And so that to me is just such an inspiration. And I do believe your optimism is both well-founded. I think Christianity is about as optimistic a worldview as you can find. And I think your determination to share that optimism is much needed in a world right now that outside of, you know, religious and often specifically Christian venues, there's so little optimism for the future in the world, which we see in, you know, zombie stories and apocalyptic, which is a terrible word for destruction stories, because of course apocalypse,
dystopian novels
and
the meaning crisis too.
So I really appreciate you, Warren, and like I said, I've been wanting to get you on the channel for a while and share you a bit, because I think also, especially for men need role models of faith, and not just what one of the things I like about your story is you've managed to transcend Christian communities without necessarily having to, you know, dismiss or talk down about them, but recognize that, you know, these were stages in God's own journey in you.
Yeah.
And that's an important, a lot of people who are not familiar with the church find the diversity of traditions within the church confusing, a cause of skepticism or doubt at times. But, you know, I do like Richard Foster's metaphor. That's one of the books I keep, you know, the streams of living water, where he sees these different traditions of the church as manifesting certain perspectives on the heart of God. And I do believe, this is an idea from Tim Keller, that when these moments of revival, which I don't mean tents and sawdust, but I mean points in time in human history when God seems to just sort of flow, and the church, I mean, it happened in Korea, it happened in America, it happened in England, and there've been smaller revivals where God just sort of explodes on the scene. And what Tim Keller noted, he actually got this from one of his seminary professors, that when those moments hit, all of these streams sort of come together, and it's prayer, and it's spiritual gifts, and it's breakthroughs in hymnody and music, and breakthroughs in theology and ideas. It's basically like the Christian community hits a flow state, and you know, for a period of time, God does an amazing work amongst his people, and the church grows dramatically. And then, you know, why God works this way, we have no idea, but this has been the pattern throughout Christian history, and we ought to, you know, these aren't things that human beings create, but as you say, one thing I think is clear by the whole way that Jesus works. I mean, Jesus' ministry itself was 72 people in a room at the end of, you know, at the end of his ministry, and then with these disciples who are very much misfits during his ministry, this thing just then quietly, slowly explodes onto the Roman world. And over a couple of centuries, you know, that was the, in a sense, the first great revival. And God can do great things.
If only we understood that more clearly. And I've been tremendously encouraged by, is it Tom Holland?
His
discussion with N.T. Wright.
Yes.
And his book about dominion.
Yes.
Because, it was actually Whitehead who convinced Lewis that, and others, that the great minds of Western history were Christian. And so that was an affront, you know, that was... a thing he was tremendously criticized for when he made that statement. But of course he's right. And now Tom Holland and people like him are giving more depth to that story. Rodney Stark is another one too. So we need to revalue our Christian heritage and claim it, and bring about the next era. And so it's not utopia, because utopia won't come in time and space. It'll come in eternity. But I don't want the world to end soon. I want it to keep going. And I want my grandkids to experience some of what I've experienced, which is really why I've written my book, so that they can see, the source of my motivation and the pleasure and enjoyment that I've experienced by being a believer in Jesus.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap up. So stay on the line. I'm just going to end the recording. But before I do end the recording, I just again want to thank you, Warren, for when you first started writing me, I want you to come to Australia to do a conference. I thought, is this for real? And it's for real. And so I even told people in the States, I'm going to go to Australia, do a conference. And they said, oh, how well do you know this guy? I thought, well, I'll go over there. And what's the worst that could happen? And it was just such a, I thought the conference was lovely. Got a chance to meet some wonderful people. But of course for me, the highlight was of course, staying with you and Elaine and just getting to know the both of you, because you're just such wonderful examples of what following Jesus can produce in us if done seriously and persistently in a lifetime of service.
Yeah, thank you.
And Elaine as well. I mean, the work that she's done in schools and with families, just in my opinion, it's Christians like you that there may never be, written about in biographies that travel through time, but Jesus knows and remembers and will reward, and I really believe that. So
yeah, that's great. I really appreciate it. I tell you what else you have said that sticks in my mind is that politics is now, and religion is always. That's a masterpiece statement, Paul, and it so typifies your contribution to my life and to the life of what is now a global audience. Thank you.
Well, thank you.